This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
You're with Ayman and Chuck on the Evening Edition. Throughout the last couple of weeks, we've been revisiting some of the key events in 2019 on our show. We've talked about things from a wide range of topics, things like the economy, the local and international politics, education and corruption, to name a few. And if you missed those segments, you can find the podcast on our app or bfm.my. Just search the keywords 2019 in review.
So now we're just about 29 hours and 55 minutes from our Sandoplo Dopo. Much of the events about BFM that we've covered have been pretty serious, as what Ayman said just now, you know, politics, education, corruption. So we figured, like, it's towards the end of the year, it's kind of a celebratory time of year. We wanted to dedicate our segment today to the lighter, more delightful news from 2019.
So before we start, if you have any thoughts to share or any event you'd like to highlight, you can call us at 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, or you can tweet us at BFM Radio. All right then, let's start with some stories from the world of animals. They are my favorite creatures. And first up is a short but delightfully sweet story from the beginning of 2019. Because that's when a swarm of bees were saved and relocated from the KLIA terminal. A nest of bees first converged at KLIA 2, and it seemed that the swarm had not built a hive, but you know, they were just migrating to find a new one. And I don't think many people knew that. Tony Fernandez tweeted his concerns about how the presence of the bees could endanger the safety of his staff and passengers.
Yeah, sadly, the fumigation was ordered, and most of the bees were killed by the airport's pest control team. But when a second swarm of bees appeared at KLIA 3 days later, MAHB was afforded a second chance and took a more humane approach by enlisting the help of bee-saving specialists, My Bee Savior.
Daripada My Bee Savior, kita telah berjaya turunkan koloni lebah tualang Apis dorsata yang berada di bumbung salah satu bangunan di KLIA. Yang mana lebah ini kita akan lepaskan di kawasan hutan yang
So, the rescue mission was a success, and MAHB praised the bee saviors as nighttime superheroes in disguise. And we reached out by text to Izzatul Lali, the secretariat at My Bee Savior. According to him, these were giant honeybees, Apis dorsata. I hope I pronounced that right.
Wow.
So he said that climate change might be affecting their migration patterns. And some experienced honey hunters have also suggested that, you know, the haze in Sumatra may have forced giant honeybee colonies to migrate away from the forest fires. Do you remember this story, Chuck? Like, where were you when this happened? And what were your thoughts back then?
Oh, dear. No, I actually don't remember the story. But I was just thinking in my head, like, bee, friendly Malaysian Association of Airports. You know, something like that. That was in my head right now. Sorry. I think it's great. Like, it's rare that people get a second opportunity like this, right? I mean, once they did it the first time and they had to, you know, sadly kill the bees, obviously social media reacted.
Yep.
And then this one rare opportunity where social media, well, where nature offers you a second chance. And I think that MAHB did a really good job by actually taking that second chance and doing something different with it.
Yeah, back then, I remember when this news came out, a lot of the conversation surrounded on the response towards it, right? So you have this dangerous situation, a swarm of bees near your workplace. How do you respond to it? And I'm so glad that eventually, finally, we reached an approach where, you know, we treat nature with respect. You know, we know these bees, they're not here to attack us. They don't have any ill intentions against us. They're migrating, running away from a bad situation where they were, trying to look for a new home. So I'm glad that we reached this response whereby we sort of like dealt with them in a delicate and respectful way. And yeah, I'm so grateful for that.
I think to Malaysian Airport's credit as well, like in a situation like this, you don't have time to like come up with a KPI, SOP or whatever, right?
Yeah.
It's like, oh, like suddenly there's, you know, a bunch of possums. Like, what do we do with the possums, you know? So with the bees, obviously, like you said, there was a clear and present danger that they might actually sting somebody or whatever. So they had to react in the most efficient way possible. But when nature afforded them a second chance, I think they did the absolute right thing.
And equally delightful was the discovery of a specific species of giant tortoise in the Galapagos Islands. And it was thought that this giant tortoise had become extinct 100 years ago, because the last and only time it was seen was back in 1906. You weren't born yet back then, Chuck.
Oh, you were.
So when a male tortoise was... they discovered it when a male tortoise was collected during an expedition.
Okay, so that's today's newsflash. Iman's actually a vampire. But Animal Planet contacted Wato Tapia, director of the Giant Tortoise Restoration Initiative, to plan a trip to Fernandina. Ooh, so many difficult words here. Where the first tortoise was actually found, to shoot an episode of the series Extinct or Alive. Wato agreed, but also made it clear that the possibility of finding a tortoise was near zero. Now, don't get me started on how a tortoise is so difficult to find, but we'll talk a little bit more about that later. But of course, it was a huge shock when Tapia and team actually went to Galapagos National Park, found the female tortoise, and named her Fernandina, of course, or Fern for short, after the island where she was found. So, okay, how the heck does something as slow as a tortoise stay hidden on an island for 100 years? It's kind of beyond me. So I was just thinking, like, what kind of tortoise was this, right? It had to be a ninja tortoise?
Oh, God. Well done, Chuck.
Several other tortoise experts collectively have estimated her age to be somewhere in the ballpark of 100 to 110 years old. She has an amazing, unique shell shape. She's got pinching at the front and back end of the shell. And most adorably, she has this cute little pink pig-like nose. And she's just a beautiful animal. She is eating, drinking, and probably most adorably, spending all of her time in her shallow little pool, because it's been so long since she's seen fresh water. For her to just sit in this pool and lap it up, she's in love. And I know there's plenty more people out there that are like me that are. And you can care enough to focus that into working towards saving species, it's the greatest thing you can do for the planet.
So Fern now resides at the Tortoise Center in Santa Cruz, and with enough funds, Tapia hopes to return to the island to see if there are more tortoises to be found.
So just to clarify, I mean, there are already like giant tortoises that are known to exist in the Galapagos. It's just this particular species was thought long dead. And actually, I mean, there's a history of this. Like, there was a fish called the Coelaclanth, which actually was thought to be extinct for a very long time. And then they found it in the ocean as well. So sometimes, you know, you think things are extinct and not. They turn out to be not because someone sees them, it's quite a cool thing, I think.
Yeah, exactly. It's like rising from the ashes, right? Like a phoenix. Perhaps a phoenix will emerge again.
I've always had this fantasy of actually doing this job of, you know, you watch BBC Earth and all those series?
Occasionally.
Yeah, and just seeing the kind of footage that they get, you know, and imagining like what it's like to be at that moment of discovery. But sometimes what we don't actually recognize is that for that moment of discovery to happen, you have to wait there for like, what, a couple of months just to capture that one moment, you know? So, yeah, we're thinking in terms of career, like, oh, that moment, but actually we don't think about the, you know, 3 months of waiting around seeing nothing.
Yeah, so you were talking earlier about second chances, right? I imagine, like, when a species emerges, like, from extinction, from what we thought was extinction, I consider that a second chance for us to do things right, you know, like, to treat them with respect and make sure they are protected and preserved for a longer time, that they can still remain with us today. So, continuing the theme of animals, in July 2019, South Korea's capital city, Seoul, officially closed down all of its remaining dog butcheries. Dog meat is consumed for its supposed health benefits, but really it was also because of food scarcity back in the day. Koreans have been doing it for more than 1,000 years, and the practice is still legal, but its popularity is declining, particularly among the younger people. And even South Korea's president adopted a dog that was rescued from a dog farm.
So as far as awareness goes, there have been more protests within the country, along with pressure that's coming, of course, internationally from people who are complaining about the cruelty of the whole thing. Activists from Humane Society International have been assisting dog farmers across the country to transition to a different livelihood as public opinion mounts against the industry. But this is actually a pretty big deal, considering that there are actually thousands of dog farms in Korea that still participate in the killing and trading of dog meat. Now, I actually have a little bit of an interesting perspective on this. Mm-hmm. I'm not necessarily convinced that this whole cruelty thing is universal, because there are actually studies that show that cruelty to animals, by definition, is also a cultural thing. So, for instance, you know, we eat chicken every day, and nobody questions, you know, that we're being cruel to the chickens. And my mom, if you're listening, I keep talking about my parents every time I come on air, but she actually had a pet chicken. And this was like, you know, 40, 50 years ago. She had a pet chicken, two actually, and she named them, okay? And then one day, they ended up on the dinner table.
Oh, but you named them already.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, there's no sanctity there, like, you know. Yeah, my grandmother did what she had to do back then, you know, when they needed food. So, yeah, they ended up on a dinner table. So it's a bit difficult to kind of say, be cruel to this and be kind to this animal, but not consider the kindness to other animals as well. I'm a dog owner myself, so I obviously do believe that dogs should be treated well, but maybe other people believe differently.
And I think that's the reason, right? Because we are, a lot of us keep dogs as pets and they are man's best friend. They're so friendly and so kind. So knowing that there are people out there who are eating dogs, it does leave quite an effect.
It is a pretty horrifying thought to me, yes. Yes.
Well, let us know what stories you consider delightful in 2019. You can call us at 7733-2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, or tweet us at BFM Radio. So, 2019 is the year that we saw Swedish teenage activist Greta Thunberg really becoming a global icon of climate change. And it all began back in August 2018, when she decided to skip school to camp in front of the Swedish parliament while holding a sign saying, "School strike for climate." And that proved to have such a great impact since then, because in just less than a year and a half, she has spoken to heads of state at the UN, she's met with the Pope, and she had a little altercation with Trump, and she also became Time Magazine's Person of the Year in 2019.
Wow, August 2018. I mean, that was like, what, 12, 13 months ago, right? And it's crazy in terms of the impact. People have talked about the Greta effect back in September. More than 4 million people around the world were inspired to come out to protest in the global climate strike. And as a consequence of an increased sense of urgency from Greta's activism, there's a bit more pressure now on politicians and companies to do their part. Of course, you know, it could be viewed as there are detractors to Greta as well, but I think overall the impact's been positive.
Yeah, exactly. So one highlight from Greta's activism so far is sailing across the Atlantic Ocean. She refuses to take planes anymore because of the carbon footprint. So she's been sailing around the world to attend climate conferences to make a point about the carbon emissions from the aviation industry. And here's part of a speech at the 25th United Nations Climate Conference in Madrid.
If there's a child standing in the middle of the road and cars are coming at full speed, you don't look away because it's too uncomfortable. You immediately run out and rescue that child. And without that sense of urgency, how can we, the people, understand that we are facing a real crisis? And if the people are not fully aware of what is going on, then they will not put pressure on the people in power to act. And without pressure from the people, our leaders can get away with basically not doing anything, which is where we are now. And around it goes. In just 3 weeks, we will enter a new decade. A decade that will define our future. Right now, we are desperate for any sign of hope. Well, I'm telling you, there is hope. I have seen it. But it does not come from the governments or corporations. It comes from the people. The people who have been unaware but are now starting to wake up. And once we become aware, we change. People can change. People are ready for change. And that is the hope because we have democracy.
So that was Greta Thunberg speaking at COP25 in Madrid back in early December. And I got to say, like, I mean, I was personally affected by her earlier speech, the How Dare You one, and by this speech as well. And I know it's not often a popular opinion sometimes when somebody younger than you is kind of telling you, you know, that you can be better than this. It's quite difficult to swallow. I guess it's a personal decision on whether you want to swallow it. So me and my girlfriend, we actually had a conversation about the carbon emissions of taking our holidays, you know, going on flights and stuff like that. So, I mean, it starts these interesting conversations that happen everywhere.
Yeah, well, while her detractors do criticize her age, right, saying that she needs to go back to school, you don't know what you're talking about, but I think her age is her strength. That is what makes her stand out the most. Like, having a young person telling you what you need to do, that should at least shame people into taking action, especially world leaders, right? And I think she has been very impactful, very influential, especially among the younger generation. I think we saw earlier in the year there was a small protest in Penang by some school children, calling the government to do better for the environment. And I do like Greta a lot. I think she's been doing so much more than what you and I have done when we were 15 or 16. And it just goes to show, like, you know, the kind of impact a young person can have in global politics and conversations surrounding it.
Yeah, it's true. Sadly, the majority of the feeling that a lot of people have towards Greta is either guilt or resentment as well. I think guilt does tend to prone people to doing positive things. But resentment sometimes maybe not, because maybe you're not doing everything that is that you're supposed to be doing for the planet. So it's a little bit difficult sometimes to look at Greta and think like, okay, this person is 15, she hasn't finished school. You know, there's a very easy target there, like, oh, you know, she doesn't know anything or whatever. But I feel that, I think as what you mentioned, her generation is the one that would actually be reaping what we're sowing right now.
Yeah, they are the ones who will be facing the impact of environmental climate change, right?
Yeah, and we were having this discussion just now, and some people actually chimed in and said like, oh, you know, I won't be around during that time and stuff like that. So we know that the consequences for her generation are the most dire, and thus there is a huge element of truth in her commitment to her message.
Anyway, we'd like to know, what are your thoughts? Has Greta Thunberg's conversation and activism shaped your own understanding of climate change, and whether it has encouraged you to do better with the environment? You can call us at 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, or you can tweet us at BFM Radio. And now we are moving on to another highlight this year, and this time it's related to toilets. So, India's Swachh Bharat mission was declared a success this year. That was the country's campaign to improve its sanitation and waste management system. The project was launched back in 2014, and throughout the past 5 years, it's managed to greatly reduce the practice of open defecation in the country.
Yep, so open defecation is a problem because it's linked to various infectious diseases such as dysentery and typhoid. back in 2014, there were still around 500 million people who were open defecators in India. So the Swachh Bharat mission, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, caught quite a bit of a global attention in terms of the all-out approach from the government. On one hand, they focused on building the infrastructure. Over 93 million toilets were built over the course of the project. That's pretty impressive, actually. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, they also addressed the behavioral aspect in terms of holding awareness and education campaigns to encourage toilet use. Because, I mean, some people who have been openly defecating might not be used to the whole practice of using a toilet.
Yeah, and here at BFM, we actually commemorated World Toilet Day. This was back in November. And one of the interviews we did was about creating new sanitation systems for places that, you know, have difficult access to water and electricity. And we spoke to Jeffrey Glass, who is the co-director at Duke University Center for WashAid. And here he talks about his project.
So a couple of key elements to this work and this development, this what is called reinventing the toilet, is the first that we're taking all the waste processing, all the processes that eliminate the pathogens or the harmful elements in human waste, and we're shrinking those processes down so that they can be part of a small solution that can go into high-density slum areas of cities and regions where the large waste processing plant may not be feasible. We also want the solution to enable small units of family units and small community units to be addressed, rather than, you know, large populations where a large solution is maybe a bit easier to develop, but it has a lot of barriers for people to utilize it. Those are all reasons that we want to shrink this waste processing down to a very manageable size. So our goal then has to be to treat the feces and the urine to make sure that they can be made pathogen-free, and the output from that treatment can be reused. So we can think of this as not only a way to treat human waste, but also a way to conserve water.
That was Jeffrey Glass, the co-director at Duke University Center for WashAid. And you can find the whole interview as well as other podcasts from our World Toilet Day special by searching World Toilet Day on our app or on bfm.my.
So moving on to a study published this year, which was rather surprising, but in a good way. This was a paper on honesty, and it was published by a team of researchers led by Alan Cohn from the University of Michigan. So the study went something like this, okay? The team got a research assistant in Finland to act as a tourist and then go up to a public counter, for example, like a bank or a post office, and saying they had found a wallet but had to rush off somewhere. Then the wallet would be handed over to the person at the counter, and the test was whether the person on the receiving end would report the wallet or keep it for themselves.
So the researchers' hypothesis was that the more money the wallet contained, the less likely it will be returned. Because that's natural, right? You see a lot of money, it would like shift your compass a bit. But it turns out that the exact opposite happened. Here's Cohn telling NPR what they found.
The highest reporting rate was found in the condition where the wallet included $100. The more money the wallet contains, the more people say that it would feel like stealing if they do not return the wallet.
So at this point, you might be thinking, you know, it's Finland, right? But the researchers replicated this with 17,000 wallets across 40 countries and found the patterns to be similar. They attributed this honesty to feelings of altruism and the unwillingness to perceive oneself as a thief. Now, I'm so curious, of course, like everyone's wondering, did the 40 countries include Malaysia?
Yeah, but I would imagine, you know, I'm optimistic about Malaysians. I think that we are all born inherently nice. So when we see a wallet with a lot of cash in it, we would return it. In fact, that is something that happened to my aunt, actually. A couple of decades ago, she got on a taxi, accidentally left an envelope with money in there. Mm-hmm. And of course, she was devastated when she found out that she left the envelope in the taxi. But thankfully, the taxi driver came back like a couple of hours later with the envelope with all the money still in it. So that is why I am optimistic and I am hopeful that Malaysians will continue to be nice people next year.
I've been on the receiving end of this karma a couple of times now. I've lost my wallet before and I left it in a field. Don't ask me what I was doing in a field. And then the next day, some Chinese Tai Chi aunties found it and gave it back to me. Mm-hmm. Then another time I left my iPod. That's how old I am. I actually used an iPod at one point in time. Left it in a cab. And that cab actually somehow found my address and dropped off the iPod in my house, which mm-hmm. was unbelievable. So I would say the hour of maybe five times in my life that I've left something behind is way more than that. But five times, I would say four out of five times, Malaysians have not let me down.
Yeah, so like if they were to do this study in Malaysia, for example, I would say that people who take the wallet are more of the exception rather than the rule.
Yeah, so what do you guys think? You can share your thoughts with us. We'd like to know, you know, if this experiment of leaving a wallet behind was actually done in Malaysia, would Malaysians actually live up to your expectations? Call us at 7733-2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, or tweet us at BFM Radio.
So today we've been looking at some of the more delightful news from 2019. You know, a lot of the news from, like, you know, because it's news, right? It's depressing. Like, it's always like bad news and really like a lot of critical stuff. So we thought, like, you know, in the lead up to the new year, we wanted to spread a little bit of joy with the positive stories that may have gone under the radar this year. So before we proceed, if you have any thoughts on these stories we're discussing, or if there's an event that you would like to highlight, you can call us at 7733-2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, or you can tweet us at BFM Radio.
Yeah, so another positive event that happened pretty recently was Silat actually gaining the UNESCO Intangible Heritage status, which is pretty cool. It's one of the 15 cultural practices that have attained the status this year. Two other Malaysian cultural forms have actually joined the list in previous years, which are Mak Yong as well as Dondang Sayang.
So earlier this month, the Bigger Picture's Lim Soo Ann spoke with Muhammad Nazrin Wahab, who is the former editor at Seni Bela Diri, which is Malaysia's only martial arts magazine. Here he elaborates on the Silat art form in Malaysia.
Silat in Malaysia is generally categorized as a martial art that's indigenous, it's traditional. It comes from the thinking, from the practices, from the culture of the local Malays. And as I think everyone understands that When we try to define what is Malay culture, we find many, many different definitions because there's so many different ways, there's so many different ethnicities within the region. So you find that there's a lot of differences, but there's also a lot of similarities. People from outside the region, when they look at us, they see, oh, it looks all the same. But practitioners, they know that there's a difference between one silat style and another. And they know this because of the history of each style. Some styles come from villages. Some styles come from the palaces.
Mm-hmm.
Some styles were actually used in combat a long, long time ago and have survived to this day. Some styles have become more philosophical, more wellness, more health-oriented. So when we talk about martial arts, typically most martial artists or most teachers will say there is no difference between one martial and another because it's a human being with two legs, two hands, one head. We are practicing based on what our body can do. But traditional silat in Malaysia is deeply rooted in the beliefs, in the narrative, in the culture of the local Malays. So you'll find that a lot of the local Malay adages, the idioms, the proverbs tie in quite a lot to what silat is.
So yeah, I mean, as a personal practitioner of martial arts as well, I actually look at silat and I find it very, very artistic. It's actually very graceful in the interactions between the two people. So you can actually find that whole conversation on our app or at bfm.my. Just search for the title, Silat, a UNESCO Intangible Cultural Heritage.
So moving on, it's more of Malaysia on the world stage because Malaysian scientist Professor Serena Nik Zainal, who is now based at the University of Cambridge, she was awarded the Joseph Steiner Prize this year, and that prize is regarded as the sort of Nobel Prize equivalent in cancer research. And her research over the past years, together with a team, has focused on developing new ways of interpreting cancer genomes. Here she speaks to Cell Press, a publisher of biomedical journals.
Cancers have many thousands of mutations, and they're not random. The mutations occur because of the different mutational processes that are going wrong in the cell as a cell goes from being a normal cell to being a cancer cell. Some of those mutational processes are intrinsic. They are because things are going wrong within the cell. Others are because of environmental factors. So in this study, a collaboration between King's College London, University of Cambridge, and the Wellcome Sanger Institute, we wanted to understand the environmental factors that are causing cancer that leave specific patterns in the genome, something we call mutational signatures. And we wanted to systematically study the mutational signatures that arise from environmental exposures. Broadly, we classified the mutations into different classes, in particular, substitutions, insertions and deletions, and double substitutions. And then we looked at the patterns that were produced by each of those different treatments. Interestingly, each treatment produced its own characteristic pattern. Sometimes a treatment produced multiple patterns, but each of the treatments had their own characteristic pattern. It's like a fingerprint for every single mutagen.
So Professor Serena has also told the press that she plans to use the funds from the award to translate the study into clinical practice in order to make cancer diagnosis and prognosis easier. So while her success is being celebrated in the scientific world today, she's voiced out before about how she's had to face discrimination due to her gender. So she recounted her experiences in an article titled The Duty to Speak Up, in which she wrote about how, for example, her concerns were not given equal weight in a male-dominated work environment.
And speaking of women in science, this year we also saw the world's first ever all-female spacewalk.
The hatch thermal cover is open. Christina, you may egress the airlock.
Copy. In work.
And that was the go-ahead from Stephanie Wilson for Christina Cook to begin heading out of the airlock. Again, the spacewalk has officially begun. We should see the spacewalkers beginning to make their way outside. Once again, this historic moment, first time that two women have done a spacewalk together.
So NASA astronauts Christina Cook and Jessica Meir made history by being the first all-woman team to venture out of their spacecraft for a spacewalk, which is not to mean they were the first women to do it. They're actually the 14th and 15th women to walk in space. Here's Jessica Meir in a phone call to President Donald Trump, who mistakenly congratulated them for conducting the first ever female spacewalk.
We don't want to take too much credit because there have been many other female spacewalkers before us. This is just the first time that there have been two women outside at the same time. And it's really interesting for us. We've talked a lot about it up here. You know, for us, this is really just us doing our job. It's something we've been training for 6 years and preparing for. At the same time, we recognize that it is a historic achievement. And we do, of course, want to give credit to all those that came before us. There have been a long line of female scientists, explorers, engineers, and astronauts. And we have followed in their footsteps to get us where we are today.
So the all-woman spacewalk wasn't intentionally planned. It was just something that was bound to happen eventually because of increasing gender diversity in astronauts. I mean, of course, I thought about that as well. Like, you know, that scene at Avengers Endgame where that girl goes like, don't worry, she's got help. You know, it's like, you don't want to stage stuff like this, right? But I mean, yeah, it's bound to happen because obviously there are more female astronauts today than maybe, you know, when astronauts first came about. So Cook's and Mayer's 2013 class of astronaut candidates was 50% women, which is the highest percentage of women of any group of astronauts candidates to date.
But actually, if you remember, the mission was almost cancelled because NASA only had one spacesuit that was the right size. So it was postponed from March until October when both Christina and Jessica were able to suit up. For a lot of people, including the astronauts themselves, the milestone was not that it was an all-female mission, but that it marked a point where hopefully spacewalks could become commonplace and normal for women.
You know, I actually thought that each spacesuit was customized for each astronaut. So it's actually quite surprising to find out that these spacesuits are more like, you know, proton sagas. That, you know, whoever takes out, you know, on that day, they just get that particular spacesuit.
Yeah, it's like one size fits all, right? So when they discovered that it was made mainly for like male bodies, right? It does bring home the fact that at the moment, it's still very much a male-dominated kind of activity. So hopefully with the spacewalk by Jessica and Christina, it will lead to greater things in the future.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Actually, another space-related first was also occurred this year. So scientists were finally able to capture an image of a black hole. You might have seen this on social media. It kind of looks like a donut, if anything. So here's Katie Bowman, an imaging scientist who led the creation of an algorithm that helped construct the first ever image of a black hole.
Well, I've seen the images for a while, but being able to share it with you all today has been spectacular. This is just like kind of the beginning of being able to have another window into what black holes can tell us about our laws and physics. But already we've learned so much. So, you know, we didn't know, even though we had predicted that if you had a black hole that you would see this ring of light, we didn't know we were going to get that ring of light. And that's, you know, what we were kind of testing. We could have gotten just a blob. And so seeing that ring, and seeing a ring that has a size that is consistent with other measurements that have been done completely differently, I think that in itself is amazing and stronger proof for black holes than so many other tests that have been done before. It's the first time we actually can see the environment right next to a black hole, the environment of a black hole.
That was Katie Bowman, an imaging scientist who led the creation of an algorithm that helped construct the first ever image of a black hole. When you first saw that picture, Chuck, were you amazed by it?
Actually, I saw the picture before I read the caption, and I actually thought it was like an ovum initially. So then after that, then, you know, looking at it for a while, then it kind of looked like the Eye of Sauron. I don't know. I mean, I guess I need to be a scientist to kind of appreciate this. Did you like go like, whoa?
It took me some reading, a while to sort of really appreciate the sort of effort and technical success that it required to capture that image, right? Because I'm gonna like spew out some nonsense scientific stuff. I think it's difficult to capture the black hole because of the light is always absorbed by the black hole or something like that. So it's really difficult. And I think they captured it using like 70 telescopes around the world or something
70?
Like that. It was, if I'm not mistaken. So it did take a lot of effort. And I myself was proud that, you know, there were scientists out there who are pushing the boundaries of scientific achievement. Because before this, we could only see black holes in movies, right? I think the closest one apparently was Interstellar. Apparently that was quite close to the calculations and scientific stuff and all that. But now we see what it actually looks like. It's just fantastic.
Actually, do you know that in Interstellar, you know, when they did that black hole scene, they actually had to create an algorithm to decide how light would actually form around the black hole. Mm-hmm. And that algorithm was actually done in consultation with a scientist.
Yeah.
And I believe there was actually a research paper launched about that algorithm to actually further clarify how black holes operate in terms of physics.
Yeah, it just shows like the amount of research taken right to do a movie like that. And it's just amazing. I respect those guys a lot.
Yeah, that's why I watch any Chris Nolan movie.
So while we are still in outer space...
And of movies
as well, maybe in galaxies far, far away, we also have this to be thankful for in 2019. Let's play it again, just in case you didn't catch that.
So that's Baby Yoda from The Mandalorian, who became an internet sensation and launched a tidal wave of OMGs.
Oh my gosh. Is it Yoda? Oh my god! Oh my god, he's so cute! Oh my god,
Yoda, I don't know what his species is.
But it's 50 years old and such a cute little baby!
It's walking.
What is he doing?
Oh my god, he's trying to heal him. Oh my god, just hold him!
Oh my god, it's so cute, I'm gonna cry.
I can't take the amount of adorableness.
A baby Yoda?
I love it so much.
Okay, Ayman, you gotta take the bulk of this one because, I mean, reaction videos is beyond my generation, lah.
Well, basically what happened, Chuck, was people were like, oh my god, Baby Yoda is so cute.
Right! No, I didn't get that from the video. So I don't think either of us have actually watched The Mandalorian.
Yeah, it's not available in Malaysia.
Yeah, so you can't actually watch it unless...
But I have seen pictures of Baby Yoda on Twitter and on the internet. It's undeniably adorable. His little face and his large eyes. It's like, he just cannot like stand it, you know?
Actually, one of my friends was super disappointed because she went to watch Rise of Skywalker, mm-hmm. and she watched the entire movie and was like, hey, where was Baby Yoda? Where was Baby Yoda? I was like, okay, yeah, it wasn't actually in the movie. It was actually in the TV series.
Yeah, and I think it's... The cynical side of me looks at it as like a money-making practice. Perhaps you can release more merchandise with like cute toys of Baby Yoda and all that. But then again, doesn't take away from the fact that it works. It's so adorable. I just can't, as the kids call it.
So you're well aware that it might be a commercial venture, but you would still buy a Baby Yoda toy.
Definitely. It's adorable.
Oh, gosh.
So that wraps up 2019 in delightful news. If there are other stories and news that should have made it into this wrap, let us know. You can call us at 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, or you can tweet us at BFM Radio. Coming up, we have the 7 o'clock news, so keep it here on the evening edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my. BFM 89.9, the business station.